Yes, thank you very much. And also, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here for the first time. So today I want to talk about how to make some progress in reconstructing the quantum gravity effect of action. But first, let me show you a little bit of my background. So most of my research is connected to asymptotic safety. Maybe you've heard of the calculation on the loop counter term in asymptotic safety. In a very nice paper, we've shown that this counter term in asymptotic safety is not fatal, it just is really an irrelevant operator. Moreover, more recently, I tried to broaden my focus and studied Hirschhaver-Lifshitz theory and set up a renormalization group flow for the first time for such a theory. I also have a side interest in condensed matter systems, for example, across the Murray models or easing model. So if you are interested in any of these topics, please come to me and chat. But today, it will be about effective field theory for gravity, quantum gravity. So this is a sketch of the talk. So I will first give you some basic ideas about CDT, causal dynamical triangulations. Because this is the point where our investigation started from specific findings that our colleagues had there. Then I will go over and explain how we extract information on the effect of action for quantum gravity from this data by setting up a matching template. Well, then having this matching template, I will make an ansatz for the effect of action and compare the results that we get with the CDT data in order to extract coupling constants. Last but not least, I will give you an outlook and where to go from here. So let me start by some basics about CDT. As I said, CDT stands for causal dynamical triangulations. What you do there is you build up space-time out of elementary atoms of space-time with one of building blocks. So geometrically, these are simply seeds. What it makes special here is really the causal structure that you put in. So for CDT, there was something called DT, so this dynamic triangulations, or EDT, Euclidean dynamic triangulations. But the phases that you find there are not that interesting. It seems that the causal structure is really crucial to get a very nice physical picture of the space time. So what you do is you you only consider foliatable manifolds, and then you introduce such a foliation, and then you can do the recrotation and, in fact, do statistics about it. So you can evaluate partition function with Monte Carlo methods. So this is very useful to actually do calculations. So one technical aspect maybe is that in general, the space-like and the time-like links of these simplices can have different lengths. So you have an asymmetry parameter, which is a coupling constant if you want. But at least to me, it's not yet clear whether this has physical relevance or not in the continuum theory. So one of the main results of CDT is the phase diagram. What you see here is phase diagram in terms of the two barrel parameters, delta and kappa zero, which correspond more or less to the Newton's constant and this asymmetry parameter. And what people have found is four different phases, phases A, B, C, B, and C, D, S. Phase A, you can imagine as kind of crumpled phase. You have baby universes, which are essentially, not talking to each other, so that's not a very nice phase. Phase C is also not so nice. There, essentially, all the volume is contained in a single time slice. It's also not so useful. Phases CDS and CB are more interesting. So CDS is really a de Sitter phase. If you impose a sphere topology, you actually get out a sphere geometry. As the expectation value of the geometry, whereas this phase CB was more recently found, and there you have an additional bifurcation structure. So if you look at volume profiles, this kind of looks like two spheres superimposed with different radii. So the most interesting phase is clearly the CDS phase. So not only have people studied the phase diagram, but also other things that you can calculate with these methods. For example, spectral dimensions. But more interestingly for us is these 2 points here can study autocorrelators of free volume fluctuations and the effect of the spatial topology. So in these simulations, you fix the topology, for example, to that of a sphere or that of a torus or whatever you like, typically a compact manifold, and then you can do the simulations. Now, these are really the results that you can get out. The left column here is for that of a topology of a sphere, whereas the right column is for the topology of a free torus. First line is the expectation value of the free volume function of time. For the sphere topology, you can see a nice sine cube behavior, which is really that of a classical sphere. Whereas for the torus, please focus on the red line. This is really a constant volume profile over all time. So it's really a flat torus that you get out. And really note, this is fully quantum. It's a quantum simulation. And you get out more or less classical volume profiles, which is a really big thing. Well, not only can you study these expectation values, but also the fluctuation spectrum around these expectation values. And this is plotted in the second line, so a 2-point correlator of fluctuations of free volume for the sphere. Well, you get something out, which is quite complicated, and for the torus as well. And here you can see that this correlator only depends on the difference of the 2 times, which is, well, inherited from the translational invariance of the torus, which you get from the flat volume profile. Now, the big question is, given these results, what can we tell about the actual quantum theory of gravity? Can we derive from these results the effective action of quantum gravity, or at least part of it? Yes?
How large are these fluctuations when normalized?
So I guess you cannot see it here, so it's a little bit shown here. So it's so this is the line here, and so about 10%, I would say, roughly.
Yes.
It's very faint. Yes. Okay. So as I said, the question is, what can we get out of this information? So. Here's the idea that we had. Let's suppose that there is an effective field theory description of quantum gravity. Let's make an ansatz for this effective action. Well, you name it. Okay, maybe there should be some Einstein-Hilbert part, some higher order corrections, you name it. From this, we calculate these correlators that I just showed you. Well, you specify your free parameters, let's say Newton's constant, some higher order couplings. You match these couplings by making a, let's say, least squares fit to extract these parameters. And if you think that the fit is sufficiently good, then you say, okay, this is a good approximation to the effective action. If not, you have to add further terms and repeat the procedure. The advantages are here twofold. On the one hand, it's really an EFT spirit, so you are not depending on the concrete UV completion of your theory, which also tells you that this approach can be used for basically any quantum gravity theory, which gives you calculatable correlation functions that you can match to an effective action prediction. On the other hand, you get access to the infrared of quantum gravity. And well, maybe you might wonder why this is important or even interesting, because, well, at least at large scales, general relativity should be a good approximation. But there's a small caveat to this. So if I talk about infrared here, I really mean deep infrared at very large scales. Experimentally, we only know that general relativity is a very good approximation up to, say, the distances of our solar system. So maybe there's still something more to learn about the infrared of quantum gravity. In particular, I want to elaborate on that point. We expect, at least, that a graviton is massless. We also have the photon that is massless. And it's a fact that massless particles are expected to generate non-local interactions in the effect of action. There are two examples for that. So you know the Dvoyakov action in two-dimensional quantum gravity. So this is exactly what I mean by non-local terms in the effect of action, something like inverse operators, inverse Laplace operators. So this is the famous Dvoyakov action. Two Ricci scalars, sandwich inverse Laplacian. As a second example of QCD, where you can actually mimic or describe the non-perturbative fluon propagator in the IR by also a non-local term. And essentially, this is a mass term. So the key question is, of course, what happens is 4D quantum gravity. Do we have a similar behavior as maybe in 2D? Do we have modifications of that? And most importantly, what are the phenomenological consequences of this? And for that, I want to elaborate a little bit on this very nice model, the Maggiore-Mantarella model, which exactly looks at a particular non-local interaction, which I show you here. So they make an ansatz. They say, OK, there's some ancient Hilbert part, general relativity, which describes solar distances, roughly. But there's this non-local part, two Ricci scalars, an inverse Laplace squared. And the motivation for this is that this acts as a kind of effective dark energy. So you could see it as a replacement for the cosmological constant. And the motivation is that, well, maybe quantum fluctuations generate such a term. So what's the phenomenological status of this model? I listed here several things. So it looks quite well. So you have an FRW background evolution, you have stable cosmological perturbations. You match a bunch of data very well, compatible statistically with the lambda CM model. One thing to note is maybe that this model predicts a finite sum of neutrino masses, contrast to the lambda CM model, which ideally predicts a zero sum of neutrino masses. It's not what we observe. So, looks quite nice. So, in Germany, we have this nice word for that. It's an Eierlegende Wollmilchsau, which means an egg-laying wool milk pig. So you could say it's a jack of all trades, right? So it kind of sounds too good to be true. But the clear question is it actually, so do quantum fluctuations generate this term? Okay, so, well, maybe let's take that seriously. Let us make an ansatz for the effect of action, ancient Hilbert part, maybe with cosmological constant. And add this non-local term. And at present, we only have data for this one correlator that I showed you. So we cannot fix more of the effect of action than the couplings that appear here.
What's the dimension of D?
Let me see. So this operator is dimensionless. So it should be dimension 2. B squared is the same dimension as R.
So B is the length of instance here. No.
Pardon?
B is the length. Or inverse length.
Inverse length, yes.
Which is different from. So to match with phenomenology, what length scale should we pick?
Well, that's what should come out from the fit now. So.
Before it matches all different logical pairs. Presumably, it's not for all values of B.
Yes, exactly. So there's a certain value of B, which I don't recall right now.
Is it cosmological then? Is it
I would have to look that up, sorry. Yes, I cannot remember, sorry. Yes, okay, so as I said, right now we have only one correlator, or data for one correlator, so we cannot fix more of the effect action, but this we can do. What's the effect of this term? It acts kind of a gauge invariant mass term for the two-point function, similar to, well, if, let me go back. Here, so if you don't consider QCD but QED and write down such a term, this is really a mass term for the transverse photon.
So,
yes?
At least the top line, there, you get the polygon action from integrating out the leader moment, right?
The what?
The leader moment. I mean, you could look
okay, yes. Yeah.
Some and there is an analog of that in four dimensions. Right?
Okay.
You can find the action for the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a somewhat different structure, well, quite a different structure from what you have there. And I was wondering if, wouldn't that be a good starting point? Because in some sense, you expect, irrespective of what happens with dark matter and anything else, just by dint of the fact that there's massless fields in the standard model, that you have that effective action as well.
Yes, so that would be certainly a good point, but it's so the action is definitely more complicated than this action. So this is really a first guess, if you want, the simplest thing that you can write down. So certainly there are corrections to this. So maybe an endomorphism to make this operator well-defined on any background. Of course, higher order terms and so on, but this is really the simplest approximation, which has one additional free parameter, this B. So. Yes, so if you want to extend this, this would be a natural point. Yes. I just set this point, so this inverse operator might or maybe should contain an endomorphism to be well defined. All right, so let's go ahead and calculate this correlator, so the correlator of free volume fluctuations. And the CDT data suggests that you have this expectation value of free volume, which is that of a sphere or that of a flat torus. So this is what we take as kind of the background structure. The expectation value of the metric is that of the torus or sphere. Then we really use the definition of free volume and take a variation to linear order. We get a scale factor cube and the trace of the spatial metric fluctuation. Now you can insert this expression into this correlator and you get this object by introducing this abbreviation hat. And well, what is this two-point function? It's a propagator of the field sigma hat. So the task is, given a certain ansatz for the effective action, to calculate the propagator of this sphere. And you can do that. So the key idea is that we use the background structure as much as possible. And on these compact backgrounds that we look at, we can use an expansion of the propagator into product eigenfunctions. So propagator is a sum over the inverse eigenvalues of the kinetic operator, let's say temporal part and spatial part, times the product of eigenfunctions in the spatial direction and in the time direction. Now, if you use this expansion and insert it into this expression, you immediately see that the spatial integrals over x and x prime project these two eigenfunctions onto the constant mode, which you have on these compact backgrounds. So this simplifies the expression a lot. You only need then to calculate temporal eigenfunctions and the temporal eigenvalues. And this is really the point where you have to specify the ansatz for the effective action. cannot go further. Because for given a certain theory, I can calculate these eigenfunctions and eigenvalues, but not in general. So this is the point where you use this specific ansatz to calculate the propagate, or the temporal part of the propagate. Now this is all good and nice. It works maybe in theory, but what about in practice? Can we actually do the calculation? If we cannot do the calculation, then we haven't won anything. So here's the real world check. So for the torus, we can do the calculation to the very end, because this is really only a Laplace equation in one dimension, so it's very easy to solve. And to actually do the summation over all modes. For the sphere, it's more difficult. There it's a more general eigenvalue problem, and there we do not know the analytic solution. So we have to do it numerically. In general, so on a general background, we expect that you get a Sommelier-Will problem, which might be singular, just probably singular on the sphere. This really depends on boundary conditions. And the general expectation for these problems is that the eigenvalues grow quadratically only. At least it's the case for the force, for example, or sphere. And if you see that, so 1 over, let's say, n squared is a very slow convergence in general. So it's very hard to get your hands on a very good approximation numerically. Because you have this very long tail you have to deal with. Okay, for these reasons, let me focus first on the torus. That's so nice. As I said already, due to the symmetry, translation symmetry, the correlator only depends on the time difference. And this is what you get out. So you can see blue dots. This is the data from the CDT and the red line, which is the fit from our prediction. So you have two coupling constants, gn, which is some number times the lattice spacing squared, and this coupling b is some other number divided by lattice spacing. Maybe we should also add that in this case, the cosmological constant is zero because we are on shell. We have a flat torus, so r is for lambda is zero. Furthermore, we can fix the relation of the extent of the torus, the radius if you want, to the lattice spacing, because we know the eigenspectrum analytically, and we can compare it to the numeric spectrum on the lattice, and we get this relation.
What's that again, sorry?
But,
R.
Yeah. This is the physical radius of the torus, so it has length R in every direction. Okay, so the comments on that. So you really need this parameter b. You can see on this right plot here, if you would set b equal to zero, if you would not include this non-local term, the fit is not really a fit. It's not fitting at all. So you really need something more than general relativity to explain the data of the CDT simulations. What we also checked is terms like r squared, r cubed, r4, and so on. What they essentially do is, so here this tip is quite, it's really a tip. If you include an r squared coupling, this tip gets rounded. It's not sharp anymore. So from this, you get a very small r squared coupling, which is of the order of the numerical error of the data. So probably close to zero, so it's consistent with zero.
Sorry.
Yes.
Does this also, did you also check for other non-local terms? Is it a generic feature that you get a good fit for non-local terms, or is it, do you have to do the
multiple box? It really depends. So you could think of R1 over box R, which would contribute to that order to a Newton's constant. You cannot disentangle that. So this is kind of the same if you want. If you would have higher orders of the inverse operator, we are even less sensitive to that because the eigenvalues, part which depends on this coupling is only sensitive to the very low eigenvalues. So the fit doesn't change too much, and we have very low resolution for these terms.
So
we cannot exclude that.
You said you're saying some non-local term should be a role.
Yes, at least this term. The other terms don't play a role so much. They so what do they do? So they don't really change at all anything. Yes.
To be clear, if you do not include the NV term,
yes,
you cannot replace it with any of these local curvature terms.
No. So an R squared term really only changes a very small region near the tip.
Okay.
And not this really qualitative behavior, this fall off. Yes.
So kind of bit on the symmetry reduction going on here, because it looks like so how does that play out with this CBT result? So you made a very specific ansatz for the
yes.
The background which says it seems to be the problems. But how does in the CBT data is that reflected? I mean, is there something in the simulation that tells you that there is some kind of symmetry there?
No, it's what comes out, right? So, so the first step is to fit the volume profile itself, and this is that of a torus or of a sphere. That's a result, and we have to fit that by the background structure, and then we look at the fluctuations around this background structure. So it's really a two-step fitting, if you want.
So that's not an input in the CBT side.
No, the input is really only the topology and the bare couplings.
Okay.
And in which phase you are.
So I have one more question. So
yes.
If you did look at other nodes to do with shapes, not just the volume, did you expect to see, is there data on that? And do you expect to see very different behavior now that it's?
I will come to that point. So yes, it's one idea to extend this is to look at other correlators, something like the fluctuation of free curvature, but we are not there yet. Yes, but I will come to that point a little bit later. Okay, so that's the torus. Let me come to the sphere. And it turns out that a similar analysis, but with different spirit, if you want, was already done by our colleagues. And we checked that the eigenvalue problem that they get, we also can derive from the action, but actually with the coupling B equal to zero. Then can extract the Newton's constant in the same way by fitting the data. And it turns out that this value is different from that of the torus. So if you go back here, you can see 0.14 in terms of lattice units on the torus. But a 0.23 in lattice units on the sphere. I should add that the relation between the lattice spacing and the physical radius is the same on the sphere and on the torus. So you might worry a little bit because, if you believe in background independence, it should not really matter which background you are on. And you should get the same result for couplings. So what's going on here? And on to write three remarks here. First remark is that on the sphere, you have certain degeneracy because you have this background curvature still floating around. If you write down R squared term, take the variation of that on a constant curvature, you will have an addition to the kinetic term, which kind of mixes with what you would call Newton's constant. So it's really not the same coupling that you look at. Furthermore, as I already said, maybe you need an endomorphism term. And on the sphere, it makes a difference because it shifts this non-local interaction. So it's maybe not really expected that we can clearly resolve a finite value of B with only one correlator. And last but not least, I should have told you before, I just realized the point that we look at where we get this data from is in this CDS phase, so the sitter phase, but really inside the phase, not near a phase transition, so not near to a continuum limit yet. So maybe the statement is that this background independence that we expect should only emerge in the continuum limit, or at least in the continuum limit. Maybe it's not fulfilled at any point in the phase in phase diagram. So picking up the question that we had a few minutes ago, of course it's clear that the more correlators we have, the better we can constrain the effect of action, right? So we have in mind two options that we can pursue at this point. One is just looking at higher order correlation functions, just putting here n fluctuations of free volume, or for example, looking at the free curvature fluctuations. And of course, you can look at the curvatures, you name it. So there's quite a number of possibilities here. But let me stick with one particular possibility where we have a result. Let's look at the three-point function. And well, how do you derive that? You take a source derivative of the two-point function, and you get this result, you get a three-point function of the effect of action contracted with free propagators. And again, the symmetry, so let's stick to the torus, the symmetry again restricts the dependence on the three arguments here down to two differences. Now I have assumed that the ansatz that we made for the effect of action, so Einstein-Hilbert plus this one non-local term, will suffice, or let's just take it and check what comes out. And so this is really a new result. You are the first people to see this, apart from Frank himself. So this is really the this correlator that I just showed you, so the three-point correlation of volume fluctuations. And you see, well, some structures and kind of quite intricate structure here, depending on the difference of T1 and T2 and T1 and T3. Well, yes, so. That's the result, and right now we are waiting for our colleagues to do the CCT simulations so that we can check and compare. The question is here really whether this the statistical quality is enough, so if people can get good enough statistics to really get this correlator. Because well, it's depending on two variables, so it's quite hard to get that maybe. But let's see, so stay tuned on that. To summarize, so what was the central idea here? We want to constrain the effect of action of quantum gravity. How do we do that? In this particular case, for CCT, we look at correlators that can be calculated in this approach. But as I said, give me any quantum theory of gravity, give me something that you can calculate. I'm making answers for the effect of action and try to calculate it as well and match data. For CDT, we found evidence for non-local action, which might have a very nice interpretation in terms of dark energy. And for future work, well, as I said, you want to continue this analysis, you want to constrain the form of non-local interactions more and get some grip on that. We want to finish the analysis that we started, so the three-point function, and want to apply it to other approaches, for example, closed sets. So there's some progress recently by the Heidelberg group, by Astrid Eichhorn and her PhD student, which might help here. So they're trying to define something like lengths or volumes on closed sets, which might make such a calculation feasible. Maybe you can also extend it to loop quantum gravity. So let's see. I'm not an expert on that. But of course, there's also the way to directly calculate these non-local terms from an RG calculation. And it's also a big topic that I want to investigate at some point to really calculate the RG equation of such form factors. Also has well, other virtues. You could tackle something like question of unitarity in asymptotic safety. So it's not only, so to say, fixing the non-local structure and nominology, but also really fundamental issues that you might or might not have in a safe. And with that, I want to end talk and thank you for your attention.
Thank you. We have plenty of time for questions. Erica?
So you mentioned that this, you did probe the data large into the face.
Yes.
So did you check how much it depends on the point of the phase-based diagram? And
not yet. So we really only have this one data point to this point. We just have to chat with our colleagues to get more data.
So you would also not have any idea how it changes if you go towards the phase solution?
No, that's really an open question and very important question. But the problem in general is CDT to actually get to the phase transition.
You know
it gets harder and harder. Yes. So. That's of course the very interesting question. Yeah. What happens?
I didn't get completely how asymptotic safety scenario linked with the presence of this type of non-local terms.
So asymptotic safety itself, not so much, but of course the techniques that we use in asymptotic safety, the functional renormalization group, can be used as a tool to calculate these non-local terms. And by calculating more general structure function like C.
You mean you start from an action containing non-local terms.
So what I have in mind is an action gamma k, which includes a term for x, where g, curvature, function of Laplace, curvature, plus another function for the while. Calculate the RG running of these two functions. And they encode, for example, these non-local interactions, but they encode more information, of course.
So how far this program is developed?
Not at all. I mean, this is really something that we want to study, but it will take quite a while to do this.
And where about in your needs?
We haven't checked that yet.
So is there evidence that you would go non-local compared to the usual? So the usual.
So usually, so one loop, you get leading logs, right? If you do one loop, you get something like log Laplace over some scale. But the question is, does anything happen non-perturbatively? And that's at present unknown.
The background field from you interpret this to be the effective action in terms of background fields. That's when you integrate out the fluctuations of some kind.
Okay.
Some masses. I mean, is that the picture? And hence your left with an IR of effective action containing the non-local terms.
Yes. If you want.
And another thing is, to use just the metric variables to parameterize potential terms in an effective action, and to compare with what you're doing with discrete theories, quantum gravity, that means you're pretty confident that there are no additional degrees of freedom that you're not putting forward just.
I'm not confident at all, but I'm saying that taking only this. Gives you something which matches the data.
Okay.
That's the statement that I make. It could be that you add, I don't know, string theory or whatever, all kinds of different aspects, and you get the same result. But this is really the minimal set that you need, and which is closest to CDT, I guess, because you also only there have gravitational degrees of freedom. But you could look at, say, Vierbein or you name it. And check it also there.
I don't really mean in that sense specifically, but I just mean that if you had something akin to the variable mode, just localize.
Sorry, the what?
If you had something akin to the variable mode, as in if you could just localize some of these non-local actions,
mm-hmm.
then you might just be better suited to look for effects of that mode in, you know, appearing in groups or in diagrams involving processes in other fields, right? I mean, if you really thought that there's a new degree of freedom arising,
mm-hmm.
then you might just, I don't know, do you see a way of systematizing that instead of hoping to look at, you know, the lattice data only? I mean, it's good to match it, but then for phenomenological checks, it might just be better off looking for, you know.
Yeah, of course. I mean, in the end, you need some data, right?
Sure.
And you want to find a model which describes the data. And what you put into the model is completely up to you. So if you think it's string theory, if you think it's group one gravity, if you believe that there is some description in terms of an effective action, you can parameterize the effective action in terms of couplings, do the calculation of the object that you have measured, and then fit the couplings. That's the general spirit, and I think it's very general.
You said that this big coupling is also it's also relevant when studying large scales cosmology, right?
Yes.
So do you have an idea of which is the dynamics where, or the running of this coupling? Because it seems like it's important, you need it in the UV, right, to fit this correlation function with the CTG data.
It's hard to say it's really UV. It's because we do not have really the flow on the CTT phase diagram yet.
Yeah.
It's hard to say which scale it is at.
Okay, so how would you know that it's not important, that it doesn't give important contributions to the scales compared to the Earth or the solar system?
So what happens is, so let's say you're approximately flat plus fluctuations, which we are in reality, right? What does this term do? It's really a cosmic, so a mass term for a scalar part of the off-shell quantum fluctuations of the metric. So in that sense, it's to lowest order as important as the cosmological constant. And this, well, more or less constrains how much it can influence solar system effects. So, I mean, so there is some, well, fitting from this phenomenological model, which gives you some number, and this really fits, I think, all data that we have observationally as good as the lambda CDM model.
So if I understand properly, you had kind of one data point so far.
Yes.
And then you feed this one parameter. So you have an a priori argument for why you expect this kind of quantum gravity things to develop an infrared structure? I mean, I understand the fit, but is there before you match up with more tests, was there an a priori reason why you would expect this?
Not really a priori.
Absence of decoupling, or so when did you try this?
So you fixed the... We tried only GR first, and we failed, as I showed you. And then we really fought hard, what do we need? So as I said, it's essentially a Laplace equation in one dimension. What terms can you add to the Laplace equation to get a good fit? And the only term that really does the trick is a mass term. And then you have to think, how can I write down a mass term in a gauge invariant way, and which does not vanish to that order on a flat background on the torus? And this is, as far as I know, the only term that fits this, these constraints.
The reason it's mass term is because of the tails.
Yes, exactly. So this is really about the large distance behavior, if you want. So this large distances.
So you want the decay to be faster.
Yes, in a sense, and really this flat reach, if you want. This is the effect of this mass term.
The mass of this, some scalar.
Exactly. So of this, let me go back. Of this field sigma hat. So this fluctuation. So sigma is a free metric. This is the background metric. This is scale factor, which is on the torus one. So this is the trace part of the spatial metric.
Is that something that would be natural from the Java Lifshitz point of view? Because there's a lot of evidence that, you know, since you have a preferred variation, mm-hmm. natural setting is going to be quite.
So I should add that so we start with a diffeomorphism invariant action. That's what we fit. Of course, you could argue that, well, CDT might be closer to Hausch-Rava than to diffeomorphism invariant quantum gravity. Yes, exactly.
You're in the Java type of phase.
Maybe, yes. But maybe in the continuum limit, you get rid of that. Maybe. Yes. So there are variation preserving terms, something like free curvature with such an inverse Laplacian, which would give the same. But here we really only restrict to diffeomorphism invariant terms. We cannot disentangle these two terms with only one correlator. They give the same contribution. So you could equally argue that, well, it's not R 1 over box squared R, but free curvature 1 over box free curvature. Yes.
So also for Java, you would find a similar non-local term.
Yes, but it stays that you need some kind of mass term if you want to get a fit.
My part said it. So from your calculations, is there any indication of flow? If the form of the non-local interaction is the one you show, how large should it be?
Sorry.
How large should the parameter be? From
your
is there any indication of how big it should be?
I mean, compared to the Planck lens, you have now.
Well, yes, so you can do the math, right? So you can take the ratio, and then you get some number.
Okay. Or is it order one?
Yeah, order one.
So it's the size of the Planck lens.
Yeah, in that order.
But you would also have a ratio when fitting to the lambda CDM.
Yes, so this does not fit. Okay. Yes, so it's not, so the physically correct way of B is not that of what you get here. But this is really, well, first of all, it's not continuum limit, second of all, it's lacking matter, and so on. So that's not something to worry about at this point, at least.
Just a little thing on that slide. So there seem to be some oscillations in the CDT data. Do you
yes.
have them?
No, we don't have them. Right now, I think these are numerical artifacts. But I'm not sure about it. So.
And maybe last question. There were a few years ago these attempts to connect CDT to Hausch-Rava Lifshitz gravity. Have you compared or looked into that as well? How your story fits into that?
I'm not sure whether we have calculated these correlators in that setting. So no, we have not.
Okay. Are there any more questions?
Well, it was not done for correlators. It was only fitting the action. Like some effective action, but it was not done by any kind of correlators.
I see.
It was quite innocent. And 3D also.
Any further questions? Let's thank Benjamin again.